Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 3 of Season 4 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we take a hilarious and poignant journey through the 1989 Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan rom-com When Harry Met Sally, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me to finish off Week 6, and unfortunately, this is his last day for a while. Maybe he'll come back later. We'll have to wait and see if anyone drops out on me and I have to try to wrangle him back in to maybe want to come talk with me again. I don't know. Is Alan Sanders of The Alan Sanders Show. Welcome back to the show, Alan.
Thank you so much for having me back and to wrap up the weekend. You're right. I can't believe how fast this week has gone by, and I'm always interested in filling in or coming off the bench if anyone has a problem and you need somebody. I, as you can tell, I enjoy talking.
Yes. And you enjoy being surprised by me, even though to be expected. You know what's to be expected, but you still get surprised. So why not?
Unlike others who might find it a little bit irritating or may even go, why do you keep doing this? I'm always like, okay, surprise me. What's going to happen today?
But before we talk about what's going to happen today, we have to give a little recap of what happened yesterday in order to continue with today. So first of all, Minute 30 begins with Marie making a very bold statement and ends with Marie talking about fairy tales. Well, who knows what we're going to be talking about there? We'll have to figure that out later in today's episode. So yesterday we ended things off. Marie and Sally are in Shakespeare & Co. They're in a very strange area of the bookstore because they have all these strange books all around them. They have a little bit of a conversation yesterday about Marie talking about, how she found Arthur's, that he spent $120 on a nightgown for his wife. Arthur is her boyfriend, I guess you can say. She's his mistress. But I don't know how do you even refer to that? She's his mistress, but he's her boyfriend? Because it can't be her.
I don't know. I know how he probably describes her.
Probably. That's probably true. She's the idiot who keeps thinking that he's going to actually leave his wife. That's who she is.
I'm sure she thinks of herself as his girlfriend, and he does not think of her that way.
as his future wife.
Yeah, no, I don't think that's what he's thinking.
No, that's what she thinks of. She thinks that she's, Mrs. Arthur, number 2, 3, 4, whatever it is. Who knows, if he's been doing this, for a long. We never get to meet Arthur. I would love to have met this guy in this movie just for a second, just to see what it is that they're trying to show us. But on the other hand, I think it actually is good that we get to use our imagination here instead of having to really worry about, who he is and things like that. Because
Nice thing about doing it this way is everyone, I think, you get to a certain point where maybe not everybody, but a vast majority of us probably have known somebody who's caught in this kind of a situation. And by not showing his face or giving us anything besides our imagination, we can plug in our own experiences or memories of having people in our lives who have found themselves in the same kind of predicament.
Right. That's true. It's a very good point. And, I think Rob Reiner and Nora Ephron knew that. And that's why they would do that. Here you have – I mean, you always have in movies these characters who just, who – sometimes they're more pivotal than in others. But in this case, here you have a guy who is very pivotal to Marie's story. He's not pivotal. Well, actually, he's also pivotal to the full story, but we'll have to get there in a few weeks about the fact of, how Marie just, completely forgets about him at some point. They this is, I think, one of the last times that they mention him. Maybe they mention him a little later, but he eventually just disappears without any real explanation as to what she did in order to stop things. But at this point, at least, she's very important in his life. He is very important in her life. Sorry. That makes a little more sense. He thinks that she, I keep saying he, Marie. I don't know why I keep doing that.
Are you okay?
I'm perfectly fine.
I know it's Friday. It's been a long week.
It's been a long week. Exactly. It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon for me. It's a long day. What can I say? So Marie feels that Arthur is very important in her life. And, you know, but the funny thing is she keeps snooping around and she finds all these little receipts all over the place, which you think he's leaving them around on purpose or he just doesn't care?
I think he doesn't care. I don't think he even thinks that she's snooping. I think he's gotten away with this for so long, and who knows how many other times he's tried to do the same thing. I don't think he cares.
Right. Right. I mean, I find it a little strange that he's walking around with a receipt in his briefcase for a nightgown that he bought for his wife. I don't know if that's the place you would put a receipt. You know, if he was trying to hide it, you know, from his wife, then, you know, well, first of all, then you could just burn it. You know, if that's the case, you don't have to keep the receipt. But,
well, I mean, if it's for his wife and his wife found it, it wouldn't be a big deal. I think he just wants to keep a surprise from her, and he's just used to keeping his personal effects in his briefcase.
Could be. I don't know.
Because what if he has to return it? What if it turns out he got the wrong size or she doesn't like it?
And well, where's he keeping the nightgown? You know, and how does she know? How does she know that?
We don't know if he's given it to her yet.
Right, but also then the question is: she only found a receipt. Maybe he actually bought the nightgown for her, and she is, you know, he hasn't given it to her yet.
Oh, there's a thought. Yeah. So, why does Marie just instantly assume the nightgown is for the wife?
Right. The kitchen table or the dining room table, I can understand. Okay, that's for the wife. You know, but here, I don't think so. You know, I have a feeling.
Interesting. You know what? I've never even thought of it that way.
Well, that's why we're doing this, Alan. So we can talk about things that we never thought about. We never would have even, you know, would have crossed our minds.
You know, absolutely. Oh, my God. That is such a good point. Maybe it was for her, and that's why it was in his briefcase. But she's just – which gives you a little insight into Marie. She's not necessarily 100% confident. You would think if she was 100% confident this relationship was heading in the right direction, she would have assumed, well, that's got to be for me.
Exactly. That's right. Maybe it's not the right size. Maybe it's a different size. You know, that's the only thing.
The only way.
That's right. That's the only way that you could really believe it. Unless she always says that she doesn't like purple and it's a purple nightgown or something like that. You know, something from that.
But they don't give us any of that detail. So you could read into it, but we don't know.
Right. Exactly. Which is why I love doing this. You know, we get to think of things that people who made the movie probably don't even think about. You know. I doubt that Rob Reiner and Nora Ephron thought about the fact that maybe this could be Marie's nightgown. You never know. But we haven't even gotten into this yet. We've been talking for 7-8 minutes, and we haven't even gotten to this minute yet. So the basically, after Marie mentions the fact that she found – yesterday, she mentioned the fact that she found the $120 receipt for the nightgown for his wife. And then she goes, I don't think he's ever going to leave her. And that's how yesterday's episode ended. And today begins with Sally going, nobody thinks he's ever going to leave her, which is such a great line. It's such a friend line. It's something that only a real friend would say.
Right.
You know,
not even cushioning the blow. It's right there in your face.
Yeah. And I mean, it just works really, really well the way that they do it. And I love Carrie Fisher / Marie's response to this. She goes, you're right. You're right. I know you're right. You know, it's a phrase that a friend of mine, he and I, we used to always say that to each other. We'd always say, you're right. You're right. I know you're right. And just quoting exactly the way that she does it, because the intonation is just great the way she says it. Mm-hmm. You know, do you think she's trying to convince herself here? I mean, she's completely in denial. That's for sure.
Yeah, and I think this is one of those moments where she still likes being in denial, but she's admitting that there is that lingering doubt in the back of her mind. So she's admitting it to her best friend, whether or not she would have admitted this to an acquaintance or somebody at work, but she's at least admitting it to Sally.
Right. Okay, that's fair. That's fair. And at this point, we get a shot of more of the book titles. And so we're now going to actually start talking about some of these book titles that are sitting on this shelf. Now, we talked about this yesterday, and I kept you in suspense about it because I decided that I wanted to talk about it just today instead of just yesterday. So there are tons of books that we get to see on here. And you were under the impression, and I was too before I did a little bit of research, that these were all fake books. But apparently they are all real books, and a lot of them you can still get today. You can buy them online. You can find copies of them. So the first one that I wanted to talk about is a book called Love Shock: How to Recover from a Broken Heart and Love Again by Connie Church and Stephen Gullo. Now, the reason I know that these are real books and this is all in a real bookstore is that book debuted on January 1st, 1988. Okay. So this movie was filmed. We talked about earlier in the week that they filmed the Giants game in October. So this is sometime over the period of 1988. So, this book came out not long beforehand, within a year. You can buy it today for $39.91 if you want. If you want a new copy. If you want a used copy, you can actually find something for $4.25 or $4.26 actually. I mean, it's great the way that you can actually just find these books that are just sitting there on the shelves. So the next book that I saw
Well,
is, yeah, go ahead.
hold on a second. I think that book title actually works very well subtly in this movie for what this movie is doing with two people who are in the middle of trying to deal with couples and relationships and breakups.
Just about every one of these books that I'm going to talk about fits that category. They knew what section to go to, and they knew whether they placed the books on the stand or the books were already there. Because you do notice that some of them there are books that are listed there that are twice. They have repeat of some of the books the way that they're shown there. But they're all relationship related, and most of them have some connection to When Harry Met Sally with the way that. With the way that the characters act and the way that things happen throughout the course of the movie. So yeah, Love Shark definitely fits in there. So here you have the next one, which is some of these you can only see part of the titles, so I had to really dig deep to try and find the full titles, and I found a lot of them. So the next one that I found was Crisis: Heterosexual Behavior in the Age of AIDS by William Masters, Virginia Johnson, and Robert Kolodny. Okay, so this is a book that you can also find right now if you want, and it also came out in the beginning of January 1988. You can buy a hardcover, a new version of it. In what's really strange is you can buy a hard copy version for $6.48, but the paperback costs $31.36. So I don't really know how that really works, why it's like that, but I don't know. So the authors of this book are Masters and Johnson. Are you familiar with Masters and Johnson? You've never heard of them?
Not just that way. Maybe I have had a knowledge of some of their other publications and books, but I not just saying it out loud that
Well,
way.
no, they're not famous for their publications. They're famous for their research. They were the first sex researchers. In the 1950s, they started. They came out at the same time as oh, what's his name? There's another famous one. The one that Liam Neeson played, Kinsey. Kinsey came out. They all started around the same time in the 50s with a whole bunch of research about sex. So William Howell Masters was born December 27th, 1915, and passed away February 16th, 2001. He was originally a gynecologist. Who started a research team, and his partner was a research assistant named Virginia E. Johnson, and they pioneered research in the nature of human sexual response and the diagnosis and treatment of sexual dysfunctions and disorders from 1957 until the 90s. So, when this movie came out, they were still doing their research at the time.
Wow. Okay.
What's interesting to me is the fact that the two of them were married to other people at the time, when they're doing all this research. And they actually both ended up getting divorced, and they married one another 14 years after they started working together. I guess they figured, let's just finally make it official, after they're doing all this
Well, I guess
research.
that
It's a
happens
place
when
where you can
you
take your
work.
work home with you.
Well, I guess the work wife became the actual wife.
That's right. Exactly.
By the way, do you have that phrase? I'm curious about that. It's something I know we hear about a lot in America, especially when a man may have a right-hand person in their organization or on their team that's of the opposite sex, and they go by the term work wife because they're always like having to contact and call and talk, and it feels like, oh my God, that's my work wife. I just want to go home to get away from her. You know, do you have that in your country? Have you
heard
that
course. Phrase of being, of course, having of course,
work wife?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. But you know, I don't use that phrase because, you know,
well, you say I don't know. I don't live there.
No, but I'm saying I wouldn't use that phrase. That's what I'm saying. I wouldn't call someone in my work wife, especially not in front of my wife. that's not the type of thing.
Well, no, technically that term usually is because it's somebody that the wife knows is connected with whatever the husband's doing, or it could be a work husband, obviously a spouse.
Right.
But your spouse is aware of her. And like, I'm just going to use the one perspective, but it's because you're so, whatever the project, whatever you're doing, you have to be in constant communication. So it's not weird. She's calling the house or texting, or you having to stop to go meet somebody together for landing a deal, whatever. So it's more than just working.
Yeah, okay.
It's
all right.
Almost like a,
right. I definitely have that, but I'm just saying, but on purpose, I don't refer to it that way. There is,
okay.
You know, within my real work, I do have that, but my wife is aware of the, you know, the women that are in my office, but you know, I never refer to them that way. Cause that would be, you know, danger, Will Robinson. There's certain things you just don't do.
Right. Right. You can only push understanding so far.
Correct. That is correct. And I think it works both ways too. I don't think I would want to, you know, have my wife refer to a work husband, you know, at the same time either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm sure you're the same way too.
Yep.
You know, too much jealousy there. Too much jealousy.
Well, I will tell you this, something my current wife and I, you know, because we both talked about early in the week, sharing our stories. We are on, this is marriage two for us. I find jealousy to be the most pointless, useless, and reckless emotion. I wish if I could get rid of one human emotion, that would be it. A lot of times you can look at negative emotions like anger or fear. Sometimes you can say, well, you need anger to maybe motivate you, or fear might keep you from going and doing something stupid. There is nothing positive. There is no way to spin jealousy leads to something good. It never does.
No. No, that I completely agree with you on, but it's out there. It's not something that we can change.
It is in fact out there, and I don't think it's going anywhere. I personally have done everything I can to completely remove it from my life. I don't think about it with other people, with other things. I've long come to the decision that if my wife decided, you know, she was going to go do things behind my back, I'm not going to worry myself sick on the what if, and I'm not going to be constantly chasing or spying or looking after. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to live my life, and I'm going to hope to be the best person I can be, and she'll want to be with me. But we know human beings, if she chooses to go somewhere else, I can't stop her. So why bother wasting all that energy on stupidity? Wait till it happens before you decide to deal with it.
That is correct.
And how about this? Do the things in your relationship you should be doing every day anyway, so that way that doesn't happen.
That's correct. That's correct. So back to Masters and Johnson.
Sorry. I was doing my own little relationship.
That's advice. Okay. That's all right. Yeah. So Johnson is Virginia E. Johnson, who was born Mary Virginia Eshelman. She was born February 11th, 1925. So she was 10 years younger than him. And she passed away on July 24th, 2013, which means that she outlived him by 12 and a half years. So I mentioned that the two of them got married in 1971, but they actually divorced in 1993. So, and as I mentioned, they were doing research up until the 90s. So I guess, you know, they just ran out of things to do research on.
They realized when the research ran out, they really didn't like each other.
Apparently.
All we had Who in knows? Common was our work, and now we don't even have that anymore.
That's right. Oh, well. So I'm not actually surprised you've never heard of them before. That's interesting.
Here's the thing. I have never found that area of – and even being a psych major, that's what I get my degree was in psychology in college, was I never found the study of sex or sex relations or physicality. I've never gone down that path. I've certainly looked at some of the modern stuff today, like the love languages and how to communicate better. But I've not really looked at the on that side, so I've just not exposed myself to that kind of research.
Right. Okay. That's fair. I didn't say, you know, I knew about, as you know, and everyone who's listening, I know a lot of things about a little, I know a little about a lot of things,
right?
You know, which is, you know, which is something that actually fascinated me as a kid. I remember I would go to the, you know, go to the library back when, you know, we used to have to go to the library to do research projects for school,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I would walk over to the librarian and I say, okay, I need to do a project on, and I give some subject that I knew nothing about. And the librarian would go, oh, okay, so you need to go get this book and that book and this one, and this is the area. And like she or he would know it right away. And it always fascinated me, you know, that I didn't need to explain what I was looking for. I just said the title and they were like, oh, I know what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so you know, because I've always been a trivia freak all my life. So, you know, I look at it from that perspective that I know a little bit about a lot of different things.
And now you're the person that's.
I was a very curious kid, and I'm still a curious person. There you go. Well, no, now they will just go to Wikipedia.
Well, they could, but your personal. Well, if your kids are like my kids, because I drive them bananas, because they know I've been around a little bit longer than them, especially when they were younger, they would say, "Dad, what is or how do I find out or who was?" I'm like, if only someone had invented a magic box where you could put a question and it would come back with answers. I'm like, Dad, yes. I don't want to look it up. I want you to tell me.
Yes, I'm a similar father that I will not give answers to my kids. They have to find it on their own. I will help them later on if they need to, but I want them to first learn how to do things on their own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which sometimes drives me nuts that they just want to be so lazy and they want me to give them all the answers.
Right.
You know, even sometimes they'll say, "Did I do this right?" And I'm like, "Well, what do you think? Did you do it right?"
Yeah.
Check your work.
Did you?
Yeah.
Dad.
Exactly. More or less. So the next book that we'll come up to is a book called Cold Feet, Why Men Don't Commit. Again, perfect for Harry. This book came out on April 19th, 1988. It was written by Sonia Rhodes and Marlon Potash. And the blurb from the book is, in explaining why men of the 80s seem unable to draw close to women, two clinicians specializing in couples therapy outlined three distinct types of males, five levels of commitment, and strategies for improving relationships. I think this is a book that Harry should have bought. It definitely makes sense, the way that works there. You can actually buy this today for $6.48 for the hardcover or the paperback is $6.12. Again, I don't know how the whole, you know, the cost system works of how you know, like why a hardcover and a paperback would be very similar price now, but I don't know.
Yeah, I don't either.
Whatever. Yeah. Right. But I mean, I love the subtitle of this book is, so it's Cold Feet, Why Men Don't Commit. And this is how to tell a good enough guy from a good for nothing. The five levels of commitment, strategies for relationships, sexual and emotional, new hope for the new male, and much more. So it's funny that Sally and Marie are standing in this area when actually Harry's the one who should be standing there. You know, maybe he's in personal growth because he's staring at the books and he's waiting for these two women to move away so he can go, you know, check out what books are there.
That's what I wanted to know from your perspective. And I know we'll get into the minute. You still got probably some other books to go through. It felt and I know times change, but it felt a little creepy, like a creeper-ish, him just kind of leering around the corner and then pretending to be reading a book. But then it just felt weird.
Yeah, you're right. All right, so I have a few more books that I'll mention here. I have two more that I have full information about, and then another one with. All right, I'll do the one that I have little information on. There's a book called I'm So Wonderful, Why Am I Alone? And that also came out on the 20th of April, 1988. That one I don't have any information about. I wasn't able to find out how much that one would cost today. There's another one, Don't Stop Now, You're Killing Me. I Love You, Let's Work It Out. You know, again, these are all real titles. Then there's another one which appears twice, which is Making Life Right When It Feels All Wrong.
I love these titles. This is awesome.
And they're real. That's the irony of the whole thing. Then the next one is Sex with Confidence. how to achieve physical and emotional intimacy in the new sexual age. Again, perfect for Harry. You know, it's a book that discusses the underlying causes of modern culture's common deviations from Judeo-Christian morality in terms of sexual practice and examines the moral implications of the teaching roles in family, in religion and family. Mm. So.
Heavy.
Exactly. Yes. Very, very much so. And then the final book is a book called Sex and Morality: Who is Teaching Our Sex Standards? Okay, that is a book that is written by Dr. Ruth Westheimer.
I know, and Dr. Ruth.
Dr. Louis Lieberman. That's right. So, all right, the first question I'm going to ask you then is, okay, what do you know about Dr. Ruth?
The Joy of Sex.
Okay. Do you know her full name, her real name?
No, I just know what she went by with her brand.
Right. So she's Carola Ruth Westheimer, and her original last name was Siegel. She was born on June 4th, 1928, and she is a German-American sex therapist, talk show host, author, professional Holocaust survivor, and former Haganah sniper. Okay, do you know what a Haganah sniper is?
No. I know what a sniper is, okay. But I cannot believe.
Right.
Okay.
She was in the War of Independence in Israel in 1948, and she was a sniper.
That's, first of all, that's cool, but that's, wow.
Yes.
That's amazing. Yes.
So she was born in Germany. When the Nazis came to power, her parents sent her when she was 10 years old to Switzerland for safety. And she stayed there for a few years. Her parents were killed in the concentration camps. After World War II ended, she immigrated to Palestine. And I'm assuming she's still the same height, but she might have shrunk a little bit. But she was 4'7" at the time. And she joined the Haganah, which was the Israeli, I guess you could say rebels at the time, you know, that were trying to fight. And she was trained as a sniper, but never actually fought in combat. Because on her 20th birthday, so apparently on June 4th, 1948, she was seriously wounded by an exploding shell from mortar fire when she was living in Jerusalem during the War of Independence at that time. And she almost lost both of her feet.
Really?
So she was then, yeah, she was then, she then moved to Paris and, you know, began physical therapy and everything like that. And then she started studying psychology at the Sorbonne, don't know how to pronounce it. And then in 1956, she immigrated to the U.S. And she put herself through graduate school by working as a maid. And then earned a MA in sociology in 1959. And then when she was 42 in 1970, she earned her doctorate from Columbia University.
Wow. This is somebody who just is always, it's like you, always wanting to learn something.
That's right. That's right. And then in 1980, okay, so she was, well, she's 52 at the time. Okay. She started a radio call-in show called Sexually Speaking, which lasted for a decade. In 1983, it became the top-rated radio show in the area. And then it became, and then she ended up launching a TV show in 1985, which was known as the Dr. Ruth Show, which attracted 2 million viewers every week. I mean, she really became very popular. She's the author of 45 books, okay, including the one that we just mentioned here. Sex mm-hmm. and Morality, Who is Teaching Our Sex Standards. Someone wrote a play about her life called Becoming Dr. Ruth. there's a documentary called Ask Dr. Ruth, which was actually very interesting. I saw it last year. It was very interesting, the whole play. She has been a very outspoken advocate about teaching about sex and things like that over the years. It's very funny that there's a journalist who described her voice as a cross between Henry Kissinger and Minnie Mouse.
That's actually perfect.
Exactly.
I've never heard that, but that is perfect. You know, if you're not going to include links, you should probably, or if you, This would be a good place to insert maybe just a minute of her talking, because that's perfect.
Okay. I will mark it down that I should do that. Yes.
Because honestly, there may be members of our audience who were not around when Dr. Ruth was like the household name, and so many movies and TV shows, and she even made cameos and things because she was so well known.
Yes. Yes. I remember she was on an episode of Quantum Leap where Sam leapt into her.
Mm-hmm.
And had to get two of her producers to get together. It was just great. It was just really, and that was like 93. You know, that was like right at the peak of her popularity. You know, so that really works. And then the scene continues. Okay, we're not going to talk about any more of the books. I think we've done enough with the books.
Okay.
Because you know, they, as we said, they all really fit into what Harry and Sally are going through. Then Marie looks up and she, you know, we see in the distance there's someone standing at the end of the aisle, you know, peeking out through the corner of a book, which is really funny. Unfortunately, we can't see the name of the book, which if we could, I would have, you know, tried to find a little bit of information about that. And then she says she like looks suspiciously at him and then walks slowly over to Sally. And then she says, someone is staring at you in personal growth. Now, why does Marie automatically think that Harry is staring at Sally as opposed to her or someone else?
I was wondering that, except doesn't she like kind of come over to Sally in the shot? You see her kind of
she walks over,
which makes me believe that she saw his eye line was not to her, but towards Sally.
Right. Okay.
Like she would have seen because of the distance that it wasn't making eye contact with her.
Right. Okay. That is probably the answer to that. But you know, it's just funny that, you know, Sally is completely oblivious, you know, that someone's looking at her, because, you know, she's too busy reading a book or looking at a book to see what, you know, whether it's something that she should buy. You know, I always find that interesting also, that people go to bookstores and they just sit there and read the books instead of, you know, like, I'm going to save a few bucks. I'll just sit here and read it instead of buying it.
I've always wondered that, why it's still the coffee shop. I get it. If you know, you want to create an atmosphere where maybe you want to read a little bit, make sure before you buy the book, but I'm like you. I'm like, hey, buy the book, go home.
That's right.
not let me serve you coffee and a donut or a beverage, and you can hang out for 5 hours here in the coffee or in the bookstore.
Right. Or show up every day and just read a chapter a day, you know, and then you'll eventually finish the book, and then you save $5 or $10 or whatever it is that you were trying to do. I don't know.
Of course, if you're buying a $5 coffee that probably cost them 12 cents, they probably don't care.
Right. That's probably true also. And then Sally looks up, sees Harry, and goes, oh, I know him. You'd like him. He's married. And I love this line. It's such a great line, because it just completely skewers Marie. You know, basically saying, you only like married men. So, of course, you're going to like this guy. And then their conversation continues. And Marie goes, who is he? And she goes, Harry Burns. He's a political consultant. Marie says, he's cute. You think he's cute? And then Marie changes the subject and goes, how do you know he's married? Because last time I saw him, he was getting married. When was that? 6 years ago. So he might not be married anymore.
How ironic.
Yeah. So first of all, it's very facetious of Marie to say that. It's as if what she's trying to say here is that no marriage is going to last anyway. So if it's been 6 years, you know, then the odds of him still being married are slim to none. You know, I guess this is something in the 80s
stays married anymore.
That's right. I mean, you wouldn't look at somebody even nowadays. I wouldn't look at somebody and say, oh, well, I knew they got married 5 years ago, so they're probably not together anymore. It would be the opposite. I would say, okay, they got married 5 years ago, they're probably still together. Unless you know something otherwise, you know. But Marie has a little skewed view on the world, and especially on someone's love life and things like that.
Just a hair.
Yeah, just a little bit, you know. Not so much, you know, Princess Leia, I don't know. Don't know. But what I find very interesting.
Once again, we talked about this. We talked about it earlier this week. They do her character in such a way that you don't think of her as kind of a bad person for sleeping with a married man. Mm-hmm. You kind of get her as she's troubled in terms of her relationships, but she's not a bad person. You still like her. And it's not because she's Princess Leia. We've mentioned that a few times, kind of tongue in cheek, but looking at it as an actual story character, she's a likable character.
Right. I completely agree with you on that. She's a very, I mean, most of the, I'm trying to think if there's anybody here that's not likable. You know, even in a few weeks, we'll see Helen. It's not as if she's not likable, but she's just, you know, it's just a few seconds that we get to see her. But you don't, you know, she's supposed to be someone that we find to be cold, and that's it.
Right.
You can't say, I hate her.
Well, I was going to say, they do that well enough that you don't necessarily hate her, but you're ambivalent maybe toward her. Correct. You don't really care.
Exactly. I think that's a great way to look at it, you know, for sure. Now, what I find very interesting, and I mentioned this a few weeks ago when they were on the plane, you know, how does Sally remember information about Harry? Like, why is it that important? You know, here we are, you know, 5-6 years later. I mean, according to the caption, it was 5 years. She obviously gets the timing slightly off by saying 6 years, but that's fine. That's perfectly natural for someone to not remember specifically. But she remembers that he's a political consultant. She remembers who he is. You know, obviously the movie is trying to show that the two of them have made a lasting impact on one another over the course of all their meets over the years. But on the other hand, you know, how many people that you just casually met 5 years ago are you going to remember information about them if you just bump into them?
I've got a perspective on this, which is great because that's my wife. I told her if I ever decided to run for political office, she would have to be glued to my side because she can remember people she met once at a party. She just catalogs it. Her brain codes it. So she's like, oh, yeah, you know, this is somebody we met at so-and-so's party 6 years ago. He works for so-and-so. They got two kids. I'm like, how do you retain that?
Wow.
She just does. She's one of those people that it just sticks in her head. And so all the time, I cannot tell you, because being in radio, I interview generally two or three people every day. So in the course of a year, I probably have had 1,000 people that I've met in my studio. I don't remember half of them if I ran into them the next day.
Oh, wow.
I'm like, oh, yeah, this is so-and-so, and this is so-and-so. I'm like, oh my God, you've got to stick by me and remind me who these people are.
Wow. Okay.
And it's not because I don't like them or anything. It's just my brain doesn't code them the way hers does.
Right. But apparently, so I guess Susan is like Sally.
Yeah, very much. For me, this was not strange at all. I'm like, that's Susan. That is my wife. She just remembers details. Like, she won't know that maybe necessarily all the detail, but she'll remember where we were, how long ago it was, what they do, whether they were married, if they have kids. It's like, how do you learn all this? And like, well, I ask questions.
Okay, but then will she think 5 years later that they might not be married again? Would that be the first thing that would come to her mind or not?
No, that would not be.
Exactly. So, you know, so that's why she's more Sally. That's right, she's more of a Sally than a Murray.
Right, she's definitely more of a Sally, but it's Sally who says that she remembers him.
Correct. Yeah, and she remembers him very, very easily. You know, it's like she doesn't even have to like strain herself. You know, I mean, when they were on the plane 5 years ago, she had to strain herself to remember Amanda's name, but she didn't have to remember Harry's name. You know, Amanda, who was her friend at some point. You know, but apparently Harry made a more lasting impression on her than Amanda did. You know,
maybe guys stick longer.
Well, she did spend 18 hours in the car with him.
That's true.
You know, in their 18-hour journey from Chicago to New York that normally takes 12 hours. But okay.
in
their world, it takes 18 hours. There you go.
I would say having girls. We've done road trips where it feels like every 25 minutes, one of them has to stop and use the bathroom.
Aha, okay. I wonder if Sally actually, you know, planned that in their journey when she planned out the whole trip, You know, she planned the stops of where they were going to switch drivers. But I wonder if she also planned, you know, where they would stop to go to the bathroom, or those were the bathroom stops. You know, when we switch every hour and a half, 2 hours, whatever it is, you know, to switch off. Don't know. So then
things to ponder. Of course.
And then Sally says, also, he's obnoxious. And then Marie goes, oh, this is just like in the movies, remember? In The Lady Vanishes, when she says to him, you're the most obnoxious man I've ever met. And then Sally corrects her, the most contemptible. And then Marie goes, then they fall madly in love. So,
not any foreshadowing happening
here.
No,
not at all. Because she does think he's obnoxious and maybe contemptible, possibly. Now, do you know, are you familiar with the movie The Lady Vanishes? No. Have you ever heard of it?
Nope.
Do you know who who directed it? You
don't even
know
who directed it? I might know.
Well, obviously, if I tell you, if I give you all the answers, how are you going to learn, Alan?
I mean, the title sounds like a Hitchcock movie.
But... And it is. You are correct.
There you go, see?
That's right.
I can use some of my parts of my brain.
There you go. It was the final...
We're still working.
That's right. It was the final British film of Alfred Hitchcock's repertoire. Okay, it came out in 1938.
Really? I didn't know that.
Came out in 1938. It starred Margaret Lockwood and Michael Redgrave. And it was based on a novel that was written 2 years earlier, The Wheel Spins, by Ethel Lena White. And it's about a beautiful English tourist traveling by train in Europe who discovers that an elderly traveling companion seems to have disappeared from the train. And so she spends the whole time trying to find this woman and figure out where you know, what happened to her. This movie actually caught Hollywood's attention. And, you know, they got Hitchcock to move to Hollywood after he made this movie, and all the rest of his movies were all made in America, because David O. Selznick believed that Hitchcock had a future in Hollywood, which I guess he did. You know, he did okay, didn't he?
Hitchcock. I'd say that was a pretty good call. Yeah.
Yes.
That was a good call.
Yeah. So the British Film Institute ranks The Lady Vanishes as the 35th best British film of the 20th century. And it is considered to be Hitchcock's most renowned British film.
Really?
Yes. Now, the full quote of in the movie that we talk about here is the character Iris Henderson says, "You're the most contemptible person I've ever met in all of my life." And the man's response is, "Confidentially, I think you're a bit of a stinker too." So the two of them really, you know, it's a Harry and Sally moment from that perspective, that no one thinks they're going to get together. And somehow they do. They find a way to get together somewhere down the line.
You know, this goes back to a little bit of a personal, my wife and I. Maybe it's because we're Northern versus Southern and by birth, but we can get into some of the best, what I would call verbal sparring. People around us would think we hate each other. Like, how are you guys even together? Even my kids at one point are like, when they were growing up, they're like, do you guys even like each other? I'm like, yes, we do. We love each other. We just love to spar too. We verbally spar all the time. But from someone on the outside, they'd go, why do you guys even? But I think it's that argument, that passion that we have to argue is the same passion that underlies the relationships that we have.
Okay, that's fair. And that's good. That keeps things you know, flowing and keeps things you always have to stay on your toes.
Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about that.
Okay, and if that works for you, that's great. It's the way.
Now there is only one problem with having a person like that in your life, when they're not playing around and you think they are.
Right.
That's when you go, we're really upset. We're not just playing around. Oops. I take back everything I said in the last 10 minutes.
Yes.
Well, by then it's too late.
Always too late. So, Alan, you have anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into the script?
No, that's I think we've done a pretty darn good job coming at it from relationships and what we're seeing and trying to figure out everything from receipts to motivations and people who can remember people who and others who can't.
Of course. Yeah, I think we've covered the gamut. No question about that, you know, but so the script, there is only one thing that's different between the script and the movie. And it's actually the quote from the movie The Lady Vanishes, because in the movie, so Sally corrects her and says the most contemptible as opposed to obnoxious. And in the script, they apparently got it wrong and they wrote the most hateful. So I find it very funny that they didn't do enough. They didn't do enough research there.
Oh, isn't it funny that maybe Nora Ephron, just because you know how it's that thing, what do they call it, the Mandela effect, where you kind of misremember something, but you swear that's got to be the way you remember it. I wonder if it took somebody on the set to go, wait a second, that's not what she said. And like, wait, what? And then they decided, well, let's go ahead and just fix it on.
That's right. And they did.
Which is kind of important. If you're going to reference an actual movie, you better get the line
true,
right.
True, but you have to also think about it. We're thinking about this from today's perspective. Today, it's much easier. You just go to IMDb. You go anywhere. You do a search on Google. You're going to be able to get the full quote. You know, back in 1988, when they were making this, or 1987, when it was being written, it wasn't as simple. You had to go actually rent the movie and watch the whole thing in order to find the actual spot where you have that quote. You know, the fact that she knew that there was this quote already is, it gives her, I give her credit for that. You know, for Nora Ephron to say when she's writing the script, oh, wait, I'm going to use the quote from The Lady Vanishes, and that really works. You know, so.
Okay, I'll give you that.
So we'll give Nora Ephron a little bit of leeway here. You know, what's a little leeway, you know, 34 years later? Why not?
Oh, she's due. Yeah. She's okay. We'll give her.
Unfortunately, Nora's no longer with us, but still, you know. So.
Right, but we still give her a pass.
Of course, we will give her a pass on this one for sure. All right. So every Friday we have a segment called Weekend Romance, where my guests will give their top five romantic comedies. So, Alan, what have you got for us?
All right, this is tougher because which is ironic, I don't like comedies, like a lot of them. I don't like, my wife tells me this all the time. I said, I'm a very funny guy. And she goes, yeah, but you don't like many comedies. I said, well, I've got a very specific thing that works for me comedic wise, but I like romantic comedies because there's more to it than just the goofiness, as long as you're following the right formula, as we mentioned earlier in the week. Right. So for me, there is only one, I would say, more recent film that fits in my top five now. And I saw it just a couple years ago, but I think it qualifies as a great rom-com. Number five, Crazy Rich Asians. That is the only, quote, modern rom-com that's in my top five.
Okay.
I think there's been too many deviations in trying to write really these crazy side plots and these unlikable characters, and they're just trying to reinvent. I'm like, no. Do the things that we like, and we'll go see the movie. So, without much, it shouldn't be a much surprise given the topic of the film that you're discussing minute by minute. My number four, thanks to you making me watch the whole thing, When Harry Met Sally. Number three, Pretty Woman. Is there a better story of Cinderella all told all over again than Pretty Woman? Fantastic. My wife and I can watch that anytime. It doesn't feel like it's ever dated or old. I love that movie.
But well, you have two more. You have two more that are coming up.
Number two. Correct. Look at you. You're like you know, deduction and reason. Number two. I think this would qualify as the first official rom-com that I saw on either rented or in the theater because of that genre. I don't know that I would have gone to see it, but I thought, well, it's got a British sense of humor. I love Monty Python, and I went to go see it. It was Four Weddings and a Funeral.
I love that movie.
Number two. Still hysterical.
Yeah, I love that movie.
And my all-time number one, it is one my wife and I watch at least once a year.
Die Hard.
Especially around Christmas. Die Hard. We could watch it anytime. Almost. It's not – the only thing is it's not a love – it's not a rom-com, unfortunately. Yes, Die Hard gets watched at the house every year, but – Love Actually.
All right. That is a great, great top five.
For us, yeah. For us, Love Actually is one of those films that does an incredible job of somehow linking all of the characters together in some way in a very believable fashion. Hollywood tried to emulate it with, I think, New Year's Day or Valentine's Day or a couple attempts. and they were so bad. Yes. But Love Actually, to this day, we could watch it. We could probably watch it 2-3 times a year and not get tired of it. And it always, always gives me the good cry at the end. I mean, my wife is like, you cry like a girl. I'm like, hey, not in today's 21st century can you tell me that. I'm in touch with my emotion.
All right, that's great. Since you're leaving us today, and maybe you'll be back, hopefully not. Hopefully no one will cancel. But if they do, I know where to go. But so you have anything else you want to say about the movie in general?
Having not seen it my whole life until this project, I knew a lot of it. I knew many of the scenes. I knew all of the actors. But I'm glad that you stumbled across or asked me to be part of this, because it forced me to see a film that really should be in my top five of romantic comedies. And now it is.
All right. What did it bump out? Do you know?
Another Julia Roberts movie. I loved Notting Hill. I've always liked Hugh Grant, no matter what. But Notting Hill would have been in my top five.
That's fair. I liked Notting Hill also. It's especially from a perspective of someone who likes movies and likes, you know, the idea that they take, okay, how does an actor's life, how can an actor's life be affected, you know, by a quote unquote normal person, you know, like a, you know, what's the peasant,
right? Someone who's not even in your same stratosphere. Exactly. I mean, you've got this super A-list actor worth millions and millions of dollars, surrounded by other A-list actors and talent. How can any one person ever match up and be part of that world? And I think part of the reason that rocks in that case is she didn't – I mean, she's looking for real, and he can't believe that she would ever see anything in him, and it's fantastic. And then at the end, as me, as a guy watching it, I'm like, ooh, there is – I've got a chance.
Well, you have to wait until you
– So you're saying there's a chance.
For sure. All right. So, Alan, you want to once again tell people how they can get in touch with Alan Sanders?
Yeah, since you start off saying for the Alan Sanders Show, that's my daily digital talk show that I do. I'm affiliated with one of the radio stations in Atlanta, Georgia, WSB. And it started last year full time. Every day I do a political talk show. So it is about the news of the day. If folks are interested in getting my perspective, you can go to the Alan, do a search for the Alan Sanders Show. That one may bend people the wrong way if you don't like certain political topics, but it's nice. I've got other pursuits. My wife and I do a show called the Marriage Fit Podcast, where we talk about what it is to be a couple, especially with kids in this modern world. And then much like you with the Movies by Minutes, I started off with my buddy Walt doing The Wilder Ride, where we broke down Young Frankenstein Season 1, and then we broke down Blazing Saddles Season 2, and then turned it into a talk show, which we try to make sure that they were evergreen with a topic. So even if it's been a couple of years, I think all those guests are worth going back and listening to.
Very cool. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter, or you can go to my website, movierobminute.com. Alan, this has been a great week. Thank you once again for joining me. I had a lot of fun. Hopefully you did too. Hopefully we both learned something. I learned a lot here also. Yeah. So hopefully all the listeners also have.
I would not be back as often as I am. First, if it wasn't that you asked me, but second, if I didn't have such a good time hanging out with you and doing this, just talking about movies. There's so many things going on in the world. When I get to kind of unplug from all of the real world and talk about what's going on in my favorite films, always a good day. All right.
Excellent. So, I will be back on Monday with a new guest. But until then, I'll have what she's having.
I'll have what she's having.
Gave me a thrill with all your faults. I love you still. It had to be you. Wonderful you. Had to be you.